Greetings from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As we record this podcast, I recognize and acknowledge that I'm located on the traditional territories of the Mississauga and Haudenosaunee nations and within the lands protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. I am Selina Mudawanu.
Greetings from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. I am Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare.
Welcome to the Black Professors Podcast.
Selina and I are faculty members who are trained in media and communication studies.
And we worked in radio and television broadcasting at some point in our careers.
Our interests include digital storytelling, radio, and alternative media forms. On the podcast, Black professors will be asked about their pathways into academia and how they found themselves in their areas of specializations. They will also be asked to talk about the political, social, and other contexts that impacted their decisions to enter academia.
Further, they will be asked to share stories about their research and teaching trajectories, high and low lights in their careers, awards and grants they won, courses they developed, as well as their current research and teaching interests.
These professors will be invited to give advice to young people in Black communities and to their early career colleagues on successfully navigating the academy.
The professors will also be requested to speak about their favorite foods, hobbies, holiday destinations, as well as how they endeavor to maintain the work-life balance.
Today we have with us Professor Gary Warner. Professor Gary Warner began his career at McMaster University as an assistant professor of French literature and later served as chair of the Department of Romance Languages, as associate dean of humanities, director of the arts and science program, as well as the founding director of McMaster International and founding co-chair of the Theme School on International Justice and Human Rights.
Dr. Warner's experience and integrity are well known and deeply regarded at McMaster and in the broader Hamilton community. He was one of the first Black professors at McMaster in 1967, where he taught courses in Francophone literature, international development, and held various administrative roles such as department chair, associate dean, co-founder, and co-director of the Theme School of International Justice and Human Rights, founding director of what is now known as the Office of International Affairs, director of the Arts and Science Program, initiator of the African Caribbean Studies in McMaster's Faculty of Humanities. He has also maintained over 50 years of robust activism for social justice. My goodness, what a profile. Thank you so much, Dr. Warner, for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much, Professor Warner. And if we were to start off with asking our questions, you have this very amazing profile, and many of us would dream to be able to do half of what you've done over these years. Had you always wanted to be a professor?
I guess when I went to university, I mean, I had no specific goal in mind, but as I came to the end of my studies, it seemed to be the next step. You know, strangely enough, when I left Trinidad on a French government scholarship, I had been offered another scholarship by the Trinidad and Tobago government, which was to study agriculture. But that is not my forte. I'd come away from in high school studying at the higher school certificate level with the British system, French, Latin, and Greek, right? So agriculture was not going to be my thing. I was a city boy with no agricultural skills. So that's how I got to France. Thanks actually to my grandmother, because you know I when I think of going to France and studying French to begin with, it was going to the market with my grandmother, and she spoke a French Creole, you know, macale, meaning I'm going, la picavini, it's going to rain, right? It's a Creole similar to some extent to what would be spoken in Saint Lucia, for example, or in Haiti. So she actually is why I studied French and why I became a French professor. Teaching, you know, I when I left, I went to high school at St. Mary's College in Port of Spain, and in my very final year before I left to go to France, I was actually hired as a junior teacher for the lower grades. So teaching was something that came sort of naturally as something to do. And as a student in France, after my scholarship ended, I received a position. I was as an assistant d'anglais, which meant that I did English conversation classes in high school. So again, I was teaching. So I sort of just rolled gently into teaching from my high school experience and my university experience, and I have loved teaching. I think I'm a natural teacher.
That is fantastic. Motilola and I, we teach various courses. And what advice would you give to people like us who are really starting out in terms of teaching?
My starting point is that the student is not an empty vessel to be filled. So your goal obviously is to transcend whatever discipline that you're teaching. But your starting point has to be that your student is an active learner who has to collaborate in that learning process, okay? Who has to be engaged. So in my experience, I would have begun a bit, you know, when I first started teaching, I was a professor, but I think it's the experience of teaching at the graduate level that first changed my style, because smaller classes, more mature students, but your goal always has to be as interactive as possible. And so in my experience, for example, when we started the theme school on international justice and human rights, I actually went to the McPherson Institute for Teaching and Learning. I went to the person who was the head of that and say, I said, you know, I'm going to be teaching this new course on development issues. I'd already switched over to development. And how can I engage? And of course, I knew that at McMaster, for the medical school, they'd brought in problem-based learning. So I asked, can you show me how to teach problem-based learning? And so that was one of the pedagogical approaches that I found very useful in terms of being able to engage students. So, you know, so we'd have a discussion around the text. Students would go off into small groups, develop all of the ideas, and come back and for sharing. And then they'd all write individual papers. Similarly, when I first started teaching an science program, again, the same quest for how can it be more engaging and collaborative. And in the arts and science program, inquiry-based learning is the pedagogical methodology.
That's wonderful. We have Grandma to thank for your career trajectory, and we're so thankful to her. What a wonderful grandma she was, I'm sure. If we take you back a bit, Gary, how did you come to Canada?
Okay, how did I come to Canada? Well, when I had finished my studies in 1966, so I had a year teaching at the University de Caen in Normandy. I had got married in 1966 as well, so it's coming up to 58 years, July 1966. And so my wife is English, so we're an interracial couple. So I wanted to teach, so I had to decide, you know, where should I go? So one of the decisions we made was that to give our marriage the best chance of success, we would not go to either of our home countries. So we didn't go to the Caribbean and we didn't go to England. So we said, okay, where else could we go? And looking around the globe, the US out of the question, because actually, as late as the 60s, interracial marriages were sort of illegal, right? In some states in the US, it was still on the books, right? And Canada, and was a very interesting period because, I didn't know this at the time, but in the 1960s, that is when Canada began to liberalize and to open up its immigration. So by the time you got to the mid 60s, 60, 66, 67, you begin to see an inflow of people, including from the Caribbean, from Africa, et cetera. So that's how we decided on the case of Canada. So I applied to actually to two universities in Canada, to Carleton and McMaster. And I got a reply from McMaster. I think in part, my thesis director, I had a wonderful thesis director in France who actually invited me to his home to discuss the chapters of the thesis as I wrote them, which was quite unusual. Anyway, so that's how we landed in Canada. And was very lucky, and it's turned out well because I've been able at McMaster to be able to live an academic life and at the same time in Hamilton to live a fulfilling community life.
That's awesome. Gary, please tell us that story about you putting your photograph on your application to McMaster. What was that about?
Well, I guess in my innocence, I guess you would call it. I thought, well, with a name like Gary, for my friend Garrett is a formal name, but Gary Warner, they have no idea because I'm not coming for a personal interview. They have no idea who is behind that name. Anybody could have that name. You cannot tell, right? So I, as a matter of principle, put my picture and included it. And it turned out that it was not a negative factor in terms of because I got the job.
That's awesome. And I really liked the way you didn't want them to make any mistakes about who you were. You wanted them to know from the get-go what they were going to get. That's awesome.
And I suppose it might be linked to the fact that that growing up in Trinidad, my school friends could be black. They could be South Asian, we would say, or East Asian in our language here, from or they could be Middle Eastern, or they could be European. So I mean, I had classmates, and I was just a normal person. Of course, I was black in Trinidad, but I was a normal person. I only discovered that I was black and different when I went to France. So I suppose at the back of my mind, it's this notion that in Trinidad, I wouldn't have to do that. But going to another country now, that maybe this is part of who I am, and I'm proud of who I am. So it's for me, it's a form of self-affirmation, which is an important part for me in terms of how we approach life. Proud of yourself, proud of who you are, because you are special.
Amazing. I love that. Proud of who you are and how you present yourself. At McMaster in 1967, what was that like?
Well, it certainly in the Faculty of Humanities, there were no other black professors, right? So I was lucky. Actually, my first night in Hamilton, I got invited to a party that some professors had set up. And so I got to meet some people, from psychology, other people from French. So that's one side of and so my department was very welcoming. But that's only one half of the story. The other half of the story is that with my wife and I going to the cafeteria on campus. So my first time, I think it was going to the cafeteria on campus. There is this server as I come by who is singing "Meeny, meeny, miny, mo." Right? I was amazed. I was amazed. So, and another sort of example of the same kind of mentality is several weeks later, when my wife and I. So we were lodged, first of all, on campus temporarily. We therefore started looking for an apartment to rent. So we went to Dundas, opposite the University Plaza in Dundas. There was an apartment there that was going, and we saw the apartment. We met the person who was, I guess, owned or co-owned, that was responsible for the apartment. And we said, oh, yes, this is a convenient location. At least to get to McMaster, get back to the campus, and we get this phone call from the person who we talked to. We'd agreed we were to rent the apartment. Get this phone call saying, I'm sorry, but the apartment actually is not available. We got some white friends to go to that same apartment, and it was available. We knew that there was an Ontario Human Rights Commission, and we did get the apartment in the end. So that for me was very formative. So because it explains why anti-racism and equity work more generally is really fundamental to my existence, if you like. Why very, very early on, so like the early 1970s, I was already an activist in an anti-racism group. There was a body called the Committee for the International Decade for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination around 1970 or so. And I became active very, very early based on that kind of experience. So good experience, very welcoming department. On the other hand, having to face issues that that 20 years daughter, my own daughter, faced in Toronto in terms of housing.
It looks like you started activism from the get-go. And so, what has it been like over 50 years that you've been doing robust activism? So, from those early days to now, what changes have you seen?
I guess what changes have I seen? So I suppose that you now have departments of equity and diversity and inclusion and anti-racism. I would say that this was really beginning around in the early 2000 or so, that this movement to recognize and to put in place structures began. So I'd say that is a difference. Of course, the populations will have changed to the extent that it's much more diverse now than it would have been, certainly in Hamilton 2000 compared to 1967. But the issues have not disappeared. The issues are still there. So it's a kind of this is not a battle that you win once and for all. It's an ongoing battle, and it takes on different manifestations, and you just have to keep at it, to keep at it with the understanding that you cannot lose. That it's especially if you start from the fundamental basis that we are all, and I come from a religious viewpoint, if we are all made in the image and likeness of God.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. And it's wonderful to hear how you really stood up against an injustice, clearly, that was going to be meted out to you. So how did you then personally survive and cope and thrive in the 1960s from all this time up until now, both at McMaster and Hamilton, generally speaking?
Okay, so the starting point is that it is not other people who define you. You define yourself, and therefore you go. So my career actually has been about following my evolving interests. So as you know, I began as a 17th century French literature specialist, having done a thesis on Molière, on French comedy, right? And I was really passionate about French comedy. But at the same time, I'd say that even while I was a student, in France, I was very active in the French Caribbean organization. There was a Catholic organization, actually, I was active in. I know I met a lot of students from Africa. I sort of got interested very early on in the literary output of I was getting to know about people like in the French Francophone world, Aimé Césaire from Martinique, Léon Gontran, Damas from French Guiana, and Léopold Sédar Senghor, who was then the president of Senegal. So there was that, and I actually saw one of Aimé Césaire's plays, La Tragédie du Roi Christophe, Tragedy of King Christophe, in Caen, in Normandy. So there was always that in my mind. And it so happened that on a trip to England, I had a chance meeting with a professor from the University of Toronto by the name of Dr. Frederick Case. Fred Case. I'm a great believer in chance meetings. The most I could do a whole podcast about chance meetings. But Tread Case, it turns out he had been a Zola, I believe, specialist, and he had switched over and had launched, therefore, African Caribbean Francophone Studies at the University of Toronto. He actually became the principal of New College, right, among other things. So thanks to Fred, I actually spent about 3 years under his guidance, becoming self-taught in Francophone African literature. So he pointed me to the things that I needed to read, both the original works as well as the critical work as well, so that I could really become versed in that literature. And also at the same time at McMaster University, I sought the advice of an anthropology professor by the name of Richard Slobodin, who was the chair of the Department of Anthropology, actually. And he introduced me as well to a lot of social science literature that I was not familiar with. So I began sort of developing my knowledge, because once I switched over from French literature to Francophone African Caribbean literature, I had to really start broadening, my understanding, and to be able to understand, the sociology and the cultural factors and the economic factors and so forth. The result of that, therefore, was that by 1972, so that's 5 years later, by 72, I was able to create and get two undergraduate courses and one graduate course, a second third-year course and a fourth-year course in Francophone, Caribbean, and African literature. And that, in turn, is what then led me to travel to on sabbatical leave to be able to deepen my knowledge to Senegal, where I was able to interview a lot of writers. Of course, I went to the University of Dakar, met several professors, was able to talk to professors, sat in some of their courses. Well, so that, and for me, of course, coming from the Caribbean of African heritage, going to Africa had that additional. And then to top up the excitement, my wife was pregnant at the time, and our third child was born actually in Dakar, Senegal. So that was to top it all off. So anyways, a long story. So that's part of my journey. As the articles I wrote, the chapter in the book that McMaster did on pedagogy, from Molière to global justice. So that is it, from Molière to African and Caribbean literature. There's still a half. Haven't got to the global justice part yet.
How important are mentors and reaching out to other people?
That is, for me, is critical. I mean, I would not have been able to do the things that I did if that were not the case. So yes, without Richard Slobodin, without Fred Case, there's no way I could have done what I did. It is really important for, particularly in the early stages, but throughout one's career, but particularly in the early stages, I think it is very, very important to have people you trust, and people who will take the time to mentor you and to give you the kind of critical guidance that you need, and people with whom you can, bounce off ideas. So that is really, really critical. And I found that, and that is what applied not only to the academic world. Like when I, for example, if I was on sabbatical leave in St. Lucia, doing some research in St. Lucia. I'm kind of proud of this, as of someone who came from a French background, that I had a published article that I know that a lot of people have quoted on the participatory management of the sea urchin fishery in St. Lucia. To be able to do that, I also had to, I spoke to a lot of people, and there were a couple of people in St. Lucia who also, again, were mentors for me in terms of helping me to understand the concepts and the environment and the to develop the knowledge that I needed to develop to be able to do this. So very important.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. And lots of exciting things that you've been talking about. I was wondering how you were able to juggle not just your academic responsibilities and activism, but also family life. I mean, your daughter being born in Dakar, you had a baby on your hands, and yet you were on sabbatical. You had academic work to do, and yet activism work to do back in Hamilton. How did you juggle many of these balls together?
Well, that's a good question. I still ask myself that question, even in retirement. How did I juggle it? Well, I guess I'm a fairly disciplined person in terms of schedules. So I really planning. If you see my schedule still, so I know what I'm going to be doing several months from now. My schedule. I mean, it's not all booked. So it's a matter of, it's a time management issue. And it's an issue as well of assigning the importance to to these things. So family is important, right? So you need time to go shopping. So for example, what had to go and in Dakar, arriving in Dakar, to go and find a place to stay, got to find furniture, go and buy furniture at the market, right? But you have friends that you can rely on as well. So I think having a circle of friends, a community around you is really important. And in the case like in Dakar, I would say that was very helpful. I had some people I met at church who were very helpful. Fred Case was in Dakar, so you know he was very, very helpful as well. So balancing, if you like, academic, your own work, your teaching, research, and I did a lot of administration as well. So there's that with the community work. And the family, they're all important. So you make sure you give time to all of them. And I guess different people will do it in different ways, but I think I must have managed okay because my wife is still here after 58 years. So the family are all together. So yeah, I must have managed okay.
And now we want to speak about your activism in Hamilton.
So the community work. So I would say that the beginning of it would have been the work that I did on the steering committee for the Hamilton United Nations Decade to combat racism. I sort of got involved. I was an Africa coordinator for Amnesty International. That is in the mid-1970s, just before going to Sierra Leone. I went to Sierra Leone for 2 years. I took a leave of absence from McMaster, and I was the director of the CUSO program, Canadian University Service Overseas. We had about 30 Canadian volunteers, and then we also ran a project division. But the one project that I'm particularly proud of that I started was a functional adult literacy program in Timni and Mendi as the languages. So the local languages, yeah, it was quite successful. It ran in about 60 or 70 villages in different regions of Sierra Leone. So it also was a bit of a peace building thing because we brought people from different parts of the country together. So I got a lot of field experience, if you like, by doing that work in Sierra Leone, being the director of that program, interfacing with ministry officials and others, as well as overseeing the volunteers. So I traveled all over the country as well. So that's good background. And then coming back from Sierra Leone, I became the chair of the board of directors for CUSO. It was exciting because, again, it gave me leadership experience, if you like, and it was an international board. So we had, and CUSO operated in Central and South America and the Caribbean. So we had people from there, from West Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, from Oceania, from Asia. So having that international connection for me was again building a lot of excitement for me in terms of internet of the community work was when Nelson Mandela was released from prison in February 1990. The local television station came to our living room to broadcast, and I was the commentator on TV for the release of as he walked out, so that was really sort of exciting. So in the 1990s, I was co-chair of a committee, the Hamilton Committee Against Racial Discrimination, for about a decade, 1990 to about 2000. I did a lot of work with immigrants and refugees. So there was an organization that no longer exists called Settlement and Integration Services Organization. So I was the chair of that. Of the board of that from 1999 to 2003. And one just before I came, when I was vice chair of that, I guess one of the things that I did was with the person who was the chair and the person who was the executive director, is we went to see at that time Hamilton. We had a regional municipality of Hamilton Wentworth and Terry Cook, the regional chairman, that's his title. So we went to see him, and when we were advocating for the creation of a regional Refugee and Immigrant Advisory Committee. That committee, he agreed. It was created in 1999, and that committee still exists today. And it's now a City of Hamilton Committee on Refugees and Immigrants. So I had a hand in bringing that into existence. I also co-chaired, the African Canadian Workers Exhibit in the 20th century. So that is still a virtual for the Hamilton Museum. You can still see this virtually. And then I got more and more involved in Hamilton. So, for example, after 9/11, in Hamilton, we had the Hindu temple that was torched, okay, severely damaged. And resulting from that, the mayor of the city created something called the Mayor's Roundtable on Strengthening Hamilton's Community Initiative, SHCI. And that committee, which was about 65 people, had a smaller group of about 20 people who were the working committee. So we did the work. And I was asked to be chair of that working committee. So, and out of that working committee came an organization that's active today called the Hamilton Center for Civic Inclusion, HCCI. And that really was one of the byproducts of SHCI, Strengthen Hamilton's Community Initiative. And I sat on the board of the HCCI. I was also very involved in poverty reduction. So I also sat on the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction for over a decade, and immigration as well for a while. I was the lead actually on an advisory committee on immigration until there was a committee that was formed with a consultant that created the Hamilton, and I sat on that committee that created the Hamilton Immigration Partnership Council, which is now an independent organization. And I also sat on the governance body of that. The other things that I would mention would be there was about 3 years or so ago, there was a young student, Devon Selby, his name was, who was killed in a school in Hamilton. And as a result, the school board, Hamilton District, created a three-person committee to advise on the reduction and elimination of bullying. And so I sat on that committee, and that committee continues to exist today. In fact, I just signed up today for a lunch meeting with that committee. And then I'm still involved in a couple of other organizations, the Good Shepherd Centers, which is it's probably the largest agency in Hamilton. So I'm the chair of the board of that at the moment. And I'm also vice chair. I'm about to become chair of the Catholic Children's Aid Society of Hamilton. But from all of that, I would say that one of my greatest joys is, I received the Order of Canada in 2005. And since 2007, I've been serving as a volunteer person for citizenship ceremonies. So I preside at citizenship ceremonies. Since COVID, I've been doing them on a lot of them online, more than in person. I think there must be tens of thousands of people that I have presided at their citizenship ceremony. So I really enjoy it. So they see me inviting new Canadians, usually from about 40 or 50 countries, becoming new Canadian citizens. And I've been doing that since 2007. So.
Thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you so much. You've mentioned lots and lots of things that you've done, and some of the honors that you've received that you have not mentioned is that you received the McMaster Students Union Lifetime Achievement Award. You also received the Royal Bank Distinguished Citizen of the Year Award, the John C. Holland Award, and of course, the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal. That's awesome. And as you also mentioned, you're a member of the Order of Canada. Very amazing stuff you've been doing, amazing work in the community, amazing work in the academy, amazing work at home too, as you've mentioned. Do you have time to relax at all?
Do I have time to relax? Yes, I do. I don't anymore, but I was an avid squash player, and in the summer I played tennis as well. I'm a reader. I like to read. This has nothing to do with work, but reading. I do crossword puzzles at night often if I'm not reading. So I love crossword puzzles. And I also do Scrabble. Do some Scrabble. So, and the Scrabble is kind of fun because doing it, we used to do it in person, But no, even with my wife, she's in one room and I'm in the other room, and we're separate to computers, and we play Scrabble, and we also have a game going with her sister in England. For a while, I played with as well with my kids, and of course, I don't so much anymore, but I love to travel. So, travel to the Caribbean, to the Mediterranean, to the Baltic, to England. I have to mention how much joy I got out of traveling in Africa, because I actually have, when I was in Sierra Leone, I was responsible for the Gambia as well. And because we were a West African region, it meant that I also traveled to Nigeria and to Ghana and to Togo. I went up to Lomé because I was an advisor. I wrote a report to recommend the creation of a CUSO program in Togo. So that's why I went to Togo. And Nigeria, of course, I've been to Nigeria a lot because we have, while I was director of McMaster International, we had a project with the University of Jos in Nigeria. So, yeah, so I've been all over Nigeria. I've been to like East and Southern Africa. So I have to tell you the story of a chance meeting I had with some professors. It turned out to be professors in the Nairobi airport, and they were professors at Makerere University in Uganda. And out of meeting them, and we had quite a discussion, we ended up with a project funded by the Canadian government, McMaster and Makerere University, and in social work. So while there, I was able to travel, to Zimbabwe, to Tanzania, and Kenya a little bit. But Uganda is the one that I would have, I know best of that region.
That's wonderful. We really need to give you a chieftaincy title now, and I'm wondering where it would be from.
One more thing, because my wife just turned 80, and she got lots of congratulations from people. But one of them was from a former South African student who was here in the, would have been in the, I guess, in the late 80s or early 90s, would have been here. And the reason why I mentioned that is because I was chair of a committee, and there was a project that was set up to bring students from South Africa specifically to McMaster University. And it was done as an alternative to stop investing in South African funds, right? In companies that were invested in South Africa. But the net result was that a number of South African students came, and I was the one that chaired the committee that was welcome, that looked after them.
Of all the countries that you have traveled, Gary, which one is the most memorable for you?
Oh, that is so difficult. That's an impossible question to answer. It's impossible because there are different things that strike you. So, for example, I mean, going on the Baltic tour and going to Russia, yeah, that was really very striking. I mean, for a different kind of reason, being in Senegal, right? It was exciting. I was there for what, an academic year, so it wasn't just popping in, right? So being able to live there and to experience the culture and to have a child born there, that was a special experience. I'm from the Caribbean. I'm from Trinidad. So any Caribbean island, so for example, the 6 months that I spent in St. Lucia as part of a leave, and we were able to get a house that was 2 minutes from the beach, right? And a lovely location, and from there I could travel all over the country, So those are some of the highlights. But I couldn't really pick any one country because there are different kinds of attractions of different places. Yes.
That's awesome. And speaking of leaving 2 minutes from the beach, I wonder what kind of food you were having there. So, what's your favorite food, if one was to ask?
Again, I would give the same kind of answer, that it's impossible for me to answer with any single food, because I'm an internationalist, right? So my tastes are also international, coming from the Caribbean. So it would be all the Creole foods, but as well as the Indian roti, right? Indian foods, Chinese foods. We have all of that in Trinidad. But in France, I got to love French food. I got to love Middle Eastern food. I love food from Vietnam, from Thai food. I have quite international tastes. I would find it hard to say I would pick one. So it's not just Caribbean food, but I love when I was, my jollof rice in Senegal. I enjoyed that, right? So I have really broad tastes.
That's awesome. And as soon as you said Senegal and jollof rice, the Nigerian in me was going to go, Nigerians have the best jollof rice. But anyway.
And so, Gary, what advice would you give to young Black people from all the experiences that you have had, some of the wins that you have had? What advice would you give to them?
Okay, so my starting advice is to know yourself and to believe in yourself. And I think that is a gift that I had growing up in Trinidad that I would say that my kids growing up in Canada didn't have. In the sense that they would grow up being kind of themselves, but other. I was not other, right? So it takes a bit more of an effort. But I'd say that has to be the starting point. Know yourself and believe in yourself and be the best that you can be. Be the best that you can be, knowing that you are special. You are special, and that we all come with unique gifts, with unique lives to offer, with a unique place in this world. And so, therefore, your job in life is to really understand. And to what are the gifts that you bring? What are the talents that you have? And how can I develop these talents? But while we are thinking of ourselves as special, other people are special too. So this is where I like to quote Ubuntu idea. You are, therefore I am. In other words, you have to be aware of the of others around you. You have to be. To be community minded, you have to think of the common good. How can you do your best for everyone around you, for your family, for your neighbors? But the common good has to be really a moral sort of really firm moral ground on which you stand. And then increasingly nowadays, and I quoted this in my, I was honored with an honorary doctorate from Marseille University, right? And I quoted this Tikkun Olam, which is a Jewish statement. From a progressive, Jewish organization, heal the planet, heal the planet. So I think it's very important to think of ourselves as part of a chain of being, that we have a responsibility to live our talents to the fullest. I really love that African story that I've read about. I wasn't taught it, but read about that. That even before you're born, that this that the The seers can tell you that these are the characteristics that you have to develop, right? So the idea is that we are born with special gifts, but we are part of life is really, I think of it, we are stardust, literally. The bad matter that has evolved over millennia that's come into is part of our bodies. And therefore, we are responsible for healing the earth, for our environmental consciousness. And from my life, I would say that you have to recognize if you are at university, you are privileged. So use your privilege for the common good. And you have to get involved in some form of social justice. You figure out what works for you, get involved in some form of social justice. So being the best that you can, means in terms of your studies, right? Achieving. Achieving that very important, but recognizing that achievement has to be linked to a bigger life purpose, which is your skills in the interest of bettering the world and protecting the world. That's what drives me.
That's awesome, Gary. Thank you so much. In a world of social media where we have filters and everyone is trying to be like everyone else, it's amazing to hear these words on marble. Believe in yourself, know that you're special, that we're all unique, and use the gifts, use your privilege for social justice. And I suppose that has driven much of what you've done all of your life. It's so wonderful to hear you say that. If I could just ask you this question about books, because you said you read books to relax as well. Which one are you currently reading?
So I'm reading a book by Brian Swim, and the title is Cosmogenesis. Cosmogenesis, and it's basically it's he was someone who's a mathematician to move from the concept of cosmology to the concept of cosmogenesis, and the difference between the two is cosmology sort of gives the idea of something that's a bit static, you know, and Thomas Berry, who's one of the people that he sort of interacts a lot with in this book, as well as with Matthew Fox. He points out that we're still living in a cosmic story in which it is us individuals and the universe, and that we have to move to a different story where it is not me individual, but it is the collective humanity, the collective Earth community. So anyway, so Matthew Swim, Cosmogenesis, and those are the kinds of ideas he is sort of developing in this particular book, in which he is rather than presented as a discipline-based story, he intertwines his own personal life. So it's a biography linked in to the story, his growing understanding of cosmogenesis, and that's the title of the book.
And to wrap up, what would you say is an accomplishment that you're most proud of in your, it might be in your research, in your teaching, or in your service? What is that accomplishment that you're most proud of?
I'll give you two of them. So one of them, I think, is in my leadership roles. It's not just one role. In my leadership roles, the ability to see the human and to get people to work together, I would say that's something that I, and it runs through, you know, when I was Associate Dean of Humanities, I often had to deal with students who were in unusual situations. And I've had students come back to me 20, 30 years later and say that I was willing to bend the rules if the rules didn't make sense in a particular case. And they would say that thanks to what your intervention, I was able to go and get out of the situation I was in and achieve things that I would otherwise not have been able to achieve. The other one, I simply mention it because I met a former colleague. I was coming out of the Pace gym today, and I met him in the parking lot of under the gym, and he said, "Oh, I wanted to tell you that I'm writing an article on the global health program at McMaster. He's recently retired and is doing an evaluation of that, and I'm using as a basis something you wrote several years ago on internationalization, where you pointed out that there are three different frames you can use in terms of how you understand and implement international work. One is a market model, in which you're obviously driven by market forces. The other is a more liberal model. And then the third is a transformational model, where you're really bringing in social analysis and you're trying to bring about, you know, to bring about change." And he says, "I'm using that as a way of evaluating the global health program at McMaster." So I'm touched that it's useful. It's something that I thought about early on, trying to make sense for myself, because when McMaster International was created, we had nothing to guide us, right? So we had to create it from scratch. We had to come up with ideas on how is this going to work, and what are the models we're going to be using, etc. So to know that's something a model that I conceived, and that was actually helpful when Patrick Dean was president of McMaster, and a group of us were part of a committee that he used to for his internationalization, and that too it was useful at that time as well. So those are a couple of things that I would say.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. You know, many times we do our work and we need to be reminded that humans are at the center of what we do. Excellent work. Thank you so much, Gary. I wondered if there's something that you would like to speak about that we have not asked you today.
The only thing I would mention is that you know, among the do land acknowledgements, you know, so one of the things that I did has to be ongoing in different forms. In terms of the indigenous populations, among other things, I actually was in the, it must have been in the 90s or early 2000s, I can't remember. I served on the Ontario Council on University Affairs. It doesn't exist anymore. And in that capacity, I was actually the Ontario Council of University Affairs representative on a body that was providing scholarships for Indigenous students. In the early 2000s to 2005, approximately, at McMaster, there was a President's Committee on Indigenous Affairs, and I served for 5 years on that committee. So I mentioned this to say that, you know, we talked about anti-racism, and we talked about social justice, talked about Amnesty International, and so human rights, and talked about poverty, we talked about immigration. I wanted to include that active attention to the Indigenous issue and relations for me is also very important.
Thank you so much for all the work that you have done throughout your career and that you continue to do right now. Thank you so much for those nuggets of wisdom. There were so many in the interview. Thank you so much.
And it's been a pleasure. You're delightful interviewers. It's been, you know, I could go on forever. You make it so such a pleasant undertaking. Thank you for your questions and for your presence, for your charming smiles.
That is all we had in this episode.
Join us next time.
And be sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. The Black Professors Podcast was established in the summer of 2023 as a space to share the often untold stories by Black professors who take us behind the scenes of their career trajectories. The co-executive producers of the Black Professors Podcast are
Dr. Selina Mudavanu, Communication Studies and Media Arts Department, McMaster University.
And Dr. Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare, African Studies Program, University of Calgary. The production team includes undergraduate and graduate students.
The title of the track used in the podcast is Podcast Hip Hop Intro Short by Corporate Sounds, accessed via Jamendo. Our sincere gratitude to the Pulse Lab at McMaster University for graciously allowing us to use the podcast recording equipment. The Black Professors Podcast is supported by generous funding from McMaster University's Arts Research Board.